I'd like now to welcome Lance Hammer. He is writer and director of the film Ballast, which is premiering at the CCA, the Center for Contemporary Arts in Santa Fe, as part of the African Effect Film Festival. It won the Best Directing and Cinematography Awards at last year's Sundance Film Festival and has won a large number of other awards as well at other film festivals. Welcome, Lance Hammer, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So this is a film about a couple of poor African-Americans in the Mississippi Delta, a mother and son, and then a man whose identical twin has died. And the film tells their story in this amazing way that avoids all dramatic film cliches, with the result being there's a real sense of honesty and reality that you really don't usually see in film. What was the starting point for this movie?
It was the Delta itself, just the natural geography, and my incessant traveling there to just be amongst the, you know, especially in the wintertime, these vast flat fields and brooding skies and the natural, you know, flora and fauna. It had such a haunting quality that I couldn't avoid making some sort of film to capture that emotion, my emotional response to that, which was largely rooted in a sense of sadness and also, you know, a great sense of awe at how small we are. And, you know, I really had a strong desire to make a film that conveyed something tonally and universal about a kind of existential, you know, sadness.
It's interesting that you say, when you talk about the big open fields and the natural world there, it seems that the relationship between the characters and that world is kind of ambivalent. It's like that those big fields are pretty inhospitable, and they experience their grief a lot of the time indoors and sometimes looking at weird things on TV and stuff like that. Tell us more about how that nature... I mean, are you from that area? Are you from the Mississippi Delta?
No, I'm from Los Angeles, but I've traveled there for about a decade now. And as I became more and more serious about a project throughout that time, it was actually a series of projects. I ended up spending many months there out of a year and going back as often as I could. So... Yeah, you know, over the course of a decade, you do learn quite a bit, and I studied it academically as well, and which was useful, but in the end, I basically tried to remove anything that had to do with the history of the place in specificity and dealt more with universals, because, you know, the more you learn about a place that you're not from, the more you actually learn how little you know, and I realized at some point along the line that I didn't really have the authority to speak about the issues that only somebody born there can speak about. So I focused, retooled my writing to deal with things that I knew intimately, which were, you know, grieving and the dignity of enduring in the face of a great sorrow or a tragedy. I employed people from the actual towns that we were shooting in to play the parts and contribute the language, and that's how I was hoping I would get at specificity of place, was through the actual people playing the parts who were born there.
So how did you develop the story itself? How much of it was a script that you gave them, and how much of it did they develop and make the story as actors?
Well, there was a script, and I took about 2 years to write it, but I always wrote dialogue as a provisional, you know, just a stand-in for what I knew I was going to try to seek from the actual people of playing the parts, you know, the people I would ultimately cast, because I was interested in the idiom, not only regional idiom, but, you know, the idiom of each individual person, which varies, and I always knew it was probably best never to show the script to the actors, because they'd never acted before. So if you're seeking truth in language and a natural delivery from the actual person, and especially if there's been no previous acting experience, a script can be very intimidating, and it can squelch the truth. And so I didn't show it to them, but instead we talked about the scenes exhaustively. We did these before we even talked about any of the actual scenario in the film. We did these psychoanalysis like sessions where I'd put two characters in a room together and we talk about their conflict, and that went on for a long time, and then we eventually started rehearsing the actual scenes, but all the language would come from each person, and I would, you know, steer them in the directions I thought the scene needed to go. But I was also hoping for things that weren't in the script that they would naturally arrive upon based upon their own life experience, and that did happen quite a bit.
It's actually stunning that these people are not professional actors, that they're ordinary people whom you found, because the acting is superb, and it's so real that, I mean, I was talking to somebody about the film afterwards. It allows you to see yourself in it, and I guess that maybe is the universality that you were striving for, because I'm not a black person from the Mississippi Delta, but the that sense of not only grief, but of love and of silence and not having the words and all these things that your actors convey, it's all there, and they didn't even have any acting training. I mean, it's extraordinary.
Well, I have a theory. I don't know if it's true or not, but it's a theory that's why it worked, is because they don't have any training. And I never, from the very first day, the very first words that I ever uttered to any of the actors were, this will not be acting. I refuse to let anybody act. all I'm interested in is you as a real human being. Everything that we're going to do should be filtered through your own emotional systems. And, you know, I'm going to suggest artificial scenarios, these artificial situations, but at all times I want you to imagine that they're actually happening in your life, and I want your responses, your words, and if you don't believe in them, let's change it. Let's change the scene. So it's you. Your behavior would be something that you would do. And I think because we started that way from day one, and that was what they thought acting was, you know, or you know, making a film was about, I think they each individually truly behaved like themselves. I mean, I watch the film now, and I see those performances, and I don't see them as performances. Those are each, you know, those are the people. That's Tara, that's Mike, that's Jamiron, and Johnny.
So did you choose...
Life, so.
Did you choose those people? I mean, first of all, how did you cast it, and did you choose people who were in their lives like the people whom you wanted to portray?
Temperamentally, absolutely. I mean, I cast. I was seeking physical demeanor and comportment, and these are this is how I cast the film. You know, before we even, you know, began to do any sort of rehearsal or even an audition, I was looking at the way somebody moved through space, the way that, you know, when I would talk to them in like an interview session, the way they would look at me, the way they would look at somebody else, and these are the most important things to me. I mean, largely because I thought the film was going to have a lot of silence anyway, and the camera was going to linger on people when they weren't saying anything or doing anything, but just being in space. And, you know, I found Mike Smith was he's the son of a preacher in Yazoo City, and I visited that church. And he became involved that way, and he also, when some of the other roles in the film were fleshed out through his congregation as well, Jamiron Ross, who plays James, I found him at the Boys and Girls Club in Canton, Mississippi. Tara responded to an open casting call in Jackson, and everybody else was, you know, off of the sidewalk or wherever. It took a long time to cast the film.
It did. I mean, so it must be funny. Here you are, this white filmmaker from Los Angeles, in this town, saying, "Hey, you want to be in the movies?" I mean,
yeah. the towns are so small that our presence was known very quickly. And then I went, like I said, I went to the churches first because I thought it was very important in these small Delta towns to first go to the patriarchal center of the community, which is the Baptist Church, and talk about the project and see if there was support. And there was, you know, I think largely because the film is about the salvation of a child in the end, so and a black child at that. So the churches were, you know, very interested in that subject. And they were also interested in the fact that I wanted to work with people from the towns and have them provide their own language and not make, you know, a Hollywood film. It was a film about this community by the people in the community. And because the churches became supportive early on, the news got out very quickly, and there was just a tremendous outpouring of, you know, acceptance and generosity, and you know, the community was really behind the project, or the communities.
And, now, this is your first film.
Yeah.
And so it's done very well in film festivals. I mean, winning the Best Directing and Cinematography Awards at Sundance is huge, and you've been all around the world with this film. What happens to your actors? Are they now looking at doing more films? Are you looking at working with them?
Yeah, Tara has played in a number of films since. She's very interested in pursuing that professionally, and I think there's been three or four films that she's been in since Ballast. And Johnny McPhail, the one, the neighbor, the one white guy in the film, is a professional actor, and he's the only person that had acting experience before this film. And he's subsequently, you know, been in a couple other films. And Mike Smith, who never acted before and doesn't really have an interest in doing it unless somebody, you know, comes to him. He's interested in acting if somebody comes to him. He just auditioned for a Sylvester Stallone film.
Wow.
And he's been up for a number of strange auditions. And Jemiren Ross has just recently been, I don't know if he's cast in this film yet or not, but he's up for this pretty big part in a larger independent film. And yeah, they're all playing around with it. But everybody lives in Mississippi, so it's very difficult to be a working actor unless you're in Los Angeles or New York. So that's a bit of a frustration for all of them.
Right, right. Correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems that you use available light, you shoot on location, you don't use musical soundtracks unless the sound is already in the scene. What are your inspirations? Are there film inspirations that you have for working in that way?
I think, yeah, there's probably film inspirations, but I think the main inspiration of other films in this regard is that it's technically capable of being done. So that's how they inspired me. Now, the real inspiration was in terms of the available light issue. It's the Delta itself. The quality of light in the Delta, especially in the overcast sky conditions, is so unique and beautiful, and it's so important to me to capture this place with as much accuracy as possible. It was never a question that I was only going to use the light that exists out of God's, you know, palette, rather than right. Having the audacity of trying to recreate our own to match that. So that was the inspiration. It's just beautiful light there. And basically the same issue applies for the sound. I was the Delta in the winter, in opposition to the way it is in the summer, is very quiet. It's very much about the quietude and the very subtle sounds that you hear in a distance and reverberating off of hardwood trees that have no leaves, and you know, the snow geese migrating. And to put music on top of that would have destroyed that very fragile quiet. So I didn't want to destroy that fragile sense of place that is largely sonic. With music, it would have intruded.
Right. Well, it's so interesting to me because most people wouldn't do that, and it's so beautiful that you did. And you actually, to my mind anyway, achieve a kind of synesthesia, because there are places where just looking at the kid in front of the heater in his house, I got cold, and you kind of smell the air and feel the dampness as you're watching it. I think because you're free of other distractions, like a soundtrack and stuff like that.
Yeah, that's a good point. It's hard for me. I'm glad you say that, because that's what I wanted to achieve. But having watched the film and edited the film for 2 years over and over and over and over and over, you know, I lost sense of whether that was being communicated or not. And that's good to know.
Well, unfortunately, we don't have any more time, but I just want to thank you so much for being with us and congratulate you on this incredible film. It's called Ballast, by Lance Hammer, whom we're talking to. He is the writer, director, and editor of the film, and it is at the Center for Contemporary Arts as part of the African Effect Film Festival. You can find out more by going to ccasantafe.org or calling 505-982-1338, and it's playing at 7:30 on Friday night and then on Saturday and all sorts of other times. So, Lance Hammer, thank you so much for being with us, and we look forward to seeing your work in the future.
Well, thank you very much for having me on your show.
We're going to take a little break right now. We'll be right back.